We'll call a subcommittee on employee. Do I start it?
Yeah, you're convening it, yes.
Legislative Coordinating Commission to order. I think we've got Mr. Representative Barrett. I think we'll go around the horn. We've got a couple of new members, at least one, two new members, Senator Dames and Representative Barrett. So, Mr. Winkler, we're starting with you. State your name for the congressional record, would you?
Mr. Chair, my name is Ryan Winkler, and I am a member from Golden Valley and District 46A.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Deborah Hillstrom. I represent all the city of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park.
Representative Bob Barrett, representing Chisago County.
Steve Draskowski, representing portions of Winona, Wabasha, Goodhue, and Dodge counties.
Okay, Senator Metzen, Northern Dakota County.
Senator Eaton, I represent Brooklyn Center and the southern half of Brooklyn Park.
Tom Saxag, representing the people of in Senate District 5, which is Bemidji, Grand Rapids, and Walker.
Senator Gary Dames, representing Senate District 16, which is Brown County, Redwood County, Lyon County, Yellow Medicine, Lacapar, and part of Renville.
See, 12 counties, but you're doing a good job.
You're counting too fast.
Okay, I think the agenda states that they're the election of officers. Is that correct? I think the chairmanship goes to the Senate this year, and the vice chairmanship goes to the House, and then the secretary is Republican Senate?
From the minority in the Senate.
Minority in the Senate. So with that...
So, Mr. Chair, can I nominate you as the chairman?
Review. Thank you. Nominations are closed. Further nominations. Everybody votes on this? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Vice Chairman on the Republican side, yes? Yeah. Who wants it? It's a great position.
I'll do it.
Thank you. Representative Drass. Kowski.
Okay, any other further nominations?
Wait
a second.
We have a parliamentary question for you, and that is whether the vice chair of the subcommittee is going to be the bill author in the House. Is that customary or is that a rule?
That's kind of right. Yeah, customary usage. Yeah.
For all these,
you want to carry this bill
for all these bills?
Uh-huh. We're going to win you over.
I can vote against the bill.
And describe it.
There's like 12 of them we do during the year, right?
Right. And you'll be presenting them.
Oh.
Yeah, I can present the bills.
You have to have your heart and soul in it. You don't have to have, but
I just have to be able to read, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, on that, what a division. All those in favor, Mr. Draskowski is the vice chair of the committee, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Congratulations, I guess. And we need, I believe, a minority member to be the secretary.
From which party? From which side? Senator House?
Senate side.
Madam, Mr. Chair, I'll nominate Senator Michelle Benson.
That's a good, yeah, she's not here.
Not here.
You're pretty quick.
That's how that works.
That works.
You can't really put down any other nominations. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Subcommittee rules, what do we have there?
Mr. Chair and members, in your packets are the proposed rules for the subcommittee to follow during this next biennium. They're the same as those that we have used in recent biennium. Provides for the election of officers to two-year terms, which you just did. A majority of the members constitutes a quorum like a normal committee does. The only other substantive thing you should know is that when we're voting on contracts and plans, the language is on page 3, line 4.5, and item 4.6. It only requires a majority of those present. We do not operate like a conference committee. It's just a majority of those present that have already established the quorum.
Okay. Do we have to do anything?
Mr. Chair, the subcommittee needs to adopt them.
Senator Eaton moves the adoption of the rules. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Who was here the last review that approved the minutes of the December 9th meeting? Senator Winkler moves it. Minutes of the December 9th meeting. Discussion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now we're going to hear about the collective bargaining agreement with the Service Employees International Union, Healthcare Minnesota. I think it'll be for discussion today, and you may, hello there, Nancy Cordes, welcome to, you may proceed and talk to us about the contract.
Thank you, Chairman Metzen and members of the subcommittee. My name is Marcy Cordes, and I'm an assistant commissioner with Minnesota Management and Budget and the state negotiator. As the senator mentioned, we'd like to present for your consideration today the negotiated labor agreement between the state and SEIU Healthcare, representing approximately 27,000 of the state's home care workers. As you know, this is the state's first contract with the unit and covers the 2015-2017 biennium. In 2013, the Minnesota legislature amended the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, the state's public sector collective bargaining law, extending organizing and collective bargaining rights to home care workers who provide services to persons in self-directed home care programs that are funded through medical assistance. In August of last year, the Bureau of Mediation Services certified the union election results, recognizing SEIU Healthcare as the exclusive representative of those eligible home care workers. As I mentioned, these are individuals that provide services as part of the state's self-directed home care programs. These programs allow service recipients to direct their own care, including hiring, directing, and training of their providers, as well as some budget management. The law designates Minnesota Management and Budget as the employer for purposes of collective bargaining, requiring us to meet and negotiate with the union on terms and conditions of employment. Following certification of the unit, a team made up of both MMB and DHS staff began negotiations, and we reached a tentative agreement through mediation on January 9th, 2015. You have a complete summary of the proposed contract provided to you by Mr. Hubinger. I thought I would initially just review the major economic items of the agreement. The contract establishes a wage floor of $10.75 per hour effective July 1, 2015, and $11 per hour effective July 1, 2016. Program participants have a right to establish wages above the wage floor. The contract also provides for paid time off. It is accrued at the rate of 1 hour for every 52 hours worked, which equals approximately 5 days off a year for a provider who works full-time. A provider must have worked at least 600 hours and must obtain the consent of their client in order to use PTO. Up to 80 hours can be carried over from 1 year to the next, and up to 80 accrued hours may be cashed out upon termination. The parties to the proposed agreement also agreed to a $250,000 training fund effective the second year of the agreement, a training orientation committee that will be comprised of representatives from both DHS and the union is also created under the agreement to identify training and orientation needs and opportunities. Because these bargaining rights are established under the Public Employer Labor Relations Act, the contract also includes other provisions that cover dispute resolution, rights of the parties, and other provisions needed to operationalize the terms of the contract. This concludes my brief summary of the economic settlement, and I will take any other questions the members might have.
Obviously, this was worked out with the MMB and the union, of course.
Yes, MMB was designated as...
Goes without saying, I suppose.
Yeah.
Discussion? Senator or Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cordes, thank you. Can you tell us how the dues structure works with this union, the ability for people to opt in and out? I understand this is a right-to-work type scenario, brought forward by the Supreme Court's decision. What can you tell us about the ability of individuals to opt in and out and how dues are articulated to them and the information they have around those as they opt in and out of the union?
Cordes.
Senator Metzen, Representative Druskowski, you are correct. This union will not be collecting what we call fair share fees in the state of Minnesota that do apply to our state public employee population. The structure, the due structure, is not something the state has the authority to set. Due structures, dues amounts, frequency of dues deductions are established by our bargaining units. Since it is not an agency shop, individuals will have the right to sign up or withdraw their membership according to whatever structure.
So the answer is it's not mandatory though, for everybody to set correct.
Correct, Senator Metzen.
Okay.
Yes, the membership is not mandatory.
Senator Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, yeah, I mean, this is for those of us that like right to work, this is the type of union we should have in all of our bargaining units in the state government, Senator. So I'm expecting you're going to carry that bill next year. Maybe not.
Maybe not. Good try, my friend. Mr.
I'm just so you said, Ms. Cordes, the bargaining unit sets the dues. Is that so? We got members who are 8,000 members who have signed cards to be in the union out of 27,000 people, if I remember correctly. How are they apprised of what the dues are, and when are they apprised of that? Relative to when they opt in the union.
Ms. Cordes, how does that work?
Senator Metzen, Representative Druskowski, the union establishes all of the parameters around what the due structure is. Typically, they do that through executive board or democratic participation, depending on the individual union and how they want to establish that structure. So I don't have any specific information, and I don't believe that the union has established whether or not the dues rates will be a lump sum or a percentage of hourly wage, or how that will be structured. The statute does require DHS to require the agencies involved to do payroll dues deduction once they receive those notifications from the union.
So Mr. Chair, I'm
Representative Druskowski.
Maybe Mr. Hubinger could tell us where. So this is the approach to dues. Is that all written in law, separate from the contracts? And are the dues articulated in any of the other contracts, or are they all expressed in law for each of them?
Mr. Hibberger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Druskowski, all of the dues structures and requirements are set through the bylaws adopted by each union, and that applies to the state employee unions that we're used to dealing with here. There's nothing in our bargaining law that relates to that issue, apart from the requirement that for the state employee unions that there's a fair share.
And that's in law. So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Cordes, if I could, Mr. Chair?
Ms. Cordes.
When are the bylaws going to be written?
Senator Metzen, Representative Druskowski, you're referring to union bylaws, SEIU bylaws. I don't have any information on when they're going to establish or set their dues rates.
So, Mr. Chair,
Druskowski.
So, Ms. Cordes, the government is entering into a contract with the union before the dues have been established and the bylaws for the union have been even written. Is that correct?
Senator Metzen, Representative Druskowski, the state doesn't have any authority over the establishment of dues or due structure with regard to any of the state's bargaining units. Really.
Somebody in the audience from the union wish to address this? Or come on up, sir. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
My name is Corey Vandenberg, committee.
Mr. Chair.
I can kind of answer this question. Again, my name is Corey Vandenberg. I'm from Oak Grove, Minnesota, and I'm on the executive board as well as the DUCE committee with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. And right now we are in deliberations working very hard on working out a structure that will work for the new home care members in our union. And the big, I guess, question to answer what you're asking right now is that the big thing that home care workers want to know is that this is our contract and this is will be the numbers that we'll be working off of before we fully set and finalize all the structures that we'll have moving forward.
Mr. Chair.
Chikowski, representative.
Thank you. And it's
Corey. Corey.
And your last name again?
Vandenberg.
And I know we met earlier. Thank you. So, Mr. Vandenberg, so what I think we're hearing is that that the government entered into a contract with the union before the people who are going to be represented in this contract were aware of what SEIU's bylaws were for this bargaining unit. Is that right?
Chair and representative, just the due structure, not the bylaws, I believe is what you're asking.
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair and Mr. Vandenberg. So, I mean, we've got 8,000 people who are going to be part of this union or want to sign up to buy a membership from you. And they are signing up without even knowing what the price of that is. So that would be, I see you shaking your head. Go ahead.
Representative, everyone will have the chance to vote on the recommendations, what the dues will be set when the time comes for that being due. So they haven't entered into any agreement on a percentage or anything like that yet. Once that's set through the committees and through the research-driven process that we're going through right now, they'll have the right to vote on it, whether or not they will agree with that. And since it is right to work, they can also then choose at that time to not be a part of this if the amount is something they're not okay with.
So, Mr. Chair and
Representative Duskowski.
And Mr. Vandenberg, so can you lay out for us how this process is going to work? Because, I mean, we are going to approve this contract today. That's what's on the agenda here. And the people, the 8,000 people, are somehow at some point in time going to be bound by this contract. And so it seems like the court is the cart is coming before the horse here, seems to be what I'm hearing, is that the people are not aware of what the dues are, and that hasn't been presented to them, and we're going to approve this before they have all the information.
Well, they get to choose later, though, right?
Exactly.
Senator Eaton, did you have a question or an answer to
a
comment?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention that the contract between the state and this organization is settled. What is not in place is how the organization wants to run itself, and that is never the employer's business. It's there are labor laws they must follow, but other than that, the employer never has a say into how the due structure is or how the membership is organized or whatever. The part that we are here today to verify is the agreement between SEIU to represent these people on a if they voluntarily join, and the state of Minnesota to recognize the union.
Representative,
so, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, I hear what Senator Eaton is saying, and I don't disagree with that, but the information that's available for these people seems to be coming after the state enters into this agreement with this organization. And I don't know. The cart seems to be coming before the horse.
Mr. Barrett, Representative Barrett, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you. I have several, actually. Mr. Chair. So the first question I have is, I don't have a copy of the contract in front of me. Do all the members of the committee have a copy of the contract in front of them?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, we typically don't produce copies for the members If you accumulate those, they're about a foot and a half thick over the course of the biennium, and so we generally just produce them, make them available online to the members. We have a copy here if you'd like to.
Okay. Well, I think for me, you know, I'm new to this committee, don't have a lot of history in this area, and need as much information as I can before I can accurately and responsibly vote on whether to approve or not approve. So that's your statement, not a question. I don't have the copy of the contract in front of me, so that's problematic to me, generally speaking, regardless of the issue. So with having said that, I'll just go to some of the other questions I have. And I'm going to – hadn't originally wanted to or intended to, but I do want to piggyback on what Representative Draskowski had mentioned, kind of his line of questioning. So let me state a question a different way. How does SEIU negotiate a contract with the state without having any understanding of what the dues would be to the members of that union?
I'm not quite sure exactly what you're asking, Representative Barrett.
What I'm asking is, from a financial and fiduciary responsibility, SEIU has negotiated with one partner and it come to an agreement without at all negotiating and agreeing or enforcing or creating a due structure for the members in which you represent. How does that happen?
Well, Representative Barrett, the members themselves are actually who will make this due structure. And so first off, we had to have members as a part of this to do this. And they won't. No one's going to be paying any dues until the contract actually goes into effect in July. And so we wanted to make sure that we understand and have all of the pieces of the contract out. And that's why right now we're going through this very deliberative process in dues committee, at which point, which the dues committee is made up of members in the home care unit, as well as the other units of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, the nursing and hospital side, at which point that recommendation will then go to the executive board, which is made up of about 50 individuals. Those 50 individuals will then take those recommendations from the dues committee. Those 50 individuals are made up of, again, home care workers, hospital workers, nursing care workers, all the different areas that we represent. We will then take those recommendations, we'll look at them over, at which time we're going to then go to the membership, and the membership is going to be able to look at what we're thinking of doing and make sure that that's going to fit with them personally, make sure that's going to be something that's going to work with us to be able, like you said, fiduciary, to be able to do what we have to do as a union, as well as so people can have an acceptable rate that's going to work with them, at which point then everyone after comes back to the executive board and we decide on a specific amount. At that point, then it'll go to the whole membership, and they'll then be able to vote on it themselves. And like Senator Eaton said, this is something that is always done in this manner. This is how it happens inside. Just as you don't set the price for that Pepsi there in front of you, you don't set the prices for these either.
Mr. Chair. You still have the option. I mean, not to...
Absolutely, yes.
Not to go ahead with it, so you could...
And at the end, if we end up during this whole process, we come up with something that just doesn't work for an individual, they can just choose to not be a part of this, and they'll still be able to have these benefits of this contract that you are going to be voting on here today, but they won't have to pay any of the due structure.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have quite a few others, but go ahead, and I think
I would give you a little break. We'll take Senator Dames for a second. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, there's kind of a couple of questions in this. First of all, it's my understanding that the members can opt in. Can they also opt out?
Absolutely. Yes, Senator. Yes, they can.
So now, what percentage of the union members would it take to change the agreement? Okay, let me come at a different angle. If the union decides they'd like to see a change in their bylaws or their agreement, what percent of the people would it take to make that change of your members?
Sure.
The due structure, is that what you're asking about?
No, not talking about the due structure. I'm talking about the general terms of the contract, the general terms and the conditions of being a member.
Senator Eaton, did you wish to respond to that? If you
yes, it would, Senator. It would be the majority of the membership would have the right to vote.
50% plus one person, then, right?
I believe so.
Okay. So then, my next question would be
majority
this:
majority of those voting.
So my next question then would be this: We're talking about this being an opt-in and an opt-out. Correct me if I'm wrong, but once the union is all set up and you have the membership, if 50% plus one of the members voting decide they want to eliminate that portion, can they do that? Can they change that so that there's no longer an opt-in and opt-out provision?
No, they cannot. Due to Harris v. Quinn in the Supreme Court, this is the structure for any home care union in the United States of America.
Thank you. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment to whether or not we can interfere in the relationship between an organization and people associated with the organization. This legislature regularly sets prices for employment in the state of Minnesota, and so we interfere a lot. And so this would not be out of our purview.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to try and clarify here by saying that these dues are a contract between two private and voluntary parties, like a gym membership. And that is, this is not something that, like if I have a gym in my community, the city doesn't tell the gym what they charge. It's basically, it's supply and demand, but the gym decides that, and the members decide if they want to pay it.
And Mr. Chair, I believe Senator Eaton was directing that towards my issue. There are lots of private contracts that we interfere in. And we do it as part of public policy, and sometimes it's good public policy. It depends on what side of the issue you're on. But we regularly set prices and boundaries in private contracts.
Mr. Barrett, we're back to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Barrett, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up again on that kind of line of thinking, you know, part of my need to know regarding what the union dues would be is to understand what portion of the amount that the state may be paying to SEIU and its members would be received by those members, and what part of that would be received by another party, SEIU. So I really can't make a good decision on that. I can't understand the benefit to one part of the contract that the state may be, which I don't have in front of me, that the state may be engaging in. I can't understand what the benefit would be to one party of that contract without understanding what your relationship is. And it's not there yet. So, I think we're kind of spinning wheels now, but I just want to let you know what my mindset is on this issue and why I feel that issue is very important. Because as you have a responsibility to your members, so do we. And we need to know what your responsibility is in order for us to understand whether this, if this was a contract, whether it would be a good one, a fair one, an okay one, a wonderful one. I don't know. So I would need to know the other half of that in order to make a good decision. But that's a comment, not a question.
Okay.
But I do have other questions, if I can.
Yep. Go ahead, Representative.
So getting back to the to the legislation that was passed and signed into law by Governor Dayton regarding the formulation of this union or the potential formulation, I understand that it created a employee-employer relationship with the state of Minnesota as it relates to bargaining only. So the question I have is probably for staff. Is that a true statement or not? I specifically remember that employees would be members, home health care would be employees of the state of Minnesota under the auspices of the Minnesota Management and Budget for contract purposes only. Is that true or not true? And I'm asking that for a follow-up question I may have.
Right. Council.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett and members, yes, that's accurate, that the legislation that established potential opportunity for exclusive representation to these workers called for them to be employees of the state only for purposes of collective bargaining.
So if I could follow up question to
Senator
that.
Barrett.
Why then would a contract that we engage in with employees of SEIU, why would there be any employer benefits in that, such as guaranteed wage and or paid time off? To me, those are terms of a separate type of employer-employee relationship that weren't covered under that legislation. And that may be a question for council, it may be a question for members, it may be a question for whoever would like to take it.
Okay, Ms. Curtis.
Thank you, Senator Metzen, Representative Barrett. Items like wages or the paid time off are considered or designated as mandatory subjects of bargaining under Chapter 128 that was passed and signed by the governor in 2013. So they're specifically designated in statute as items that we are required to meet and negotiate over with this bargaining unit.
Senator Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if council could confirm that line in legislation that related to employees for the purposes of bargaining only, does that automatically cover the issues I addressed, certain wages and benefits such as paid time off?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, I believe that is accurate. The enabling legislation identified specific, included a cross-reference to the terms that are the conditions of labor, conditions of work, and those two things are in conditions of work in elsewhere in statute. And perhaps this court can state that more precisely.
Could you add on to that?
Maybe just a thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett. Just to reiterate that in Chapter 128, which made amendments to PELRA and to other enabling legislation, terms and conditions of employment, including wages and benefits, as well as training and orientation and the operation of the registry, are specifically listed as mandatory subjects of bargaining for this specific unit.
Thank you. Representative Barrett.
Possibly one other question. Regarding the $250,000 training fee, assuming the contract is approved, signed into law, where does that money go specifically?
Curtis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barrett, the $250,000, that implementation of that benefit was delayed until the second year of the contract, which will provide the committee an opportunity to study and look at opportunities for training programs that would be funded by that amount. The monies remain within the control of the Department of Human Services, and the first year of the contract will provide an opportunity for that to be designed.
Representative Barrett.
Follow up to that. I'm not sure I heard the answer from a long-term perspective. Are you saying the $250,000 is not in the terms of the existing contract, or are you saying that that money is, through the terms of the contract, delayed in its implementation until some plan of attack can be agreed to?
Curtis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, it's not delayed to outside of the terms of this agreement. It's delayed until the second year of the labor agreement, with the idea that they'll develop a plan for spending those funds that are allocated only for the second year of the labor agreement.
Then in regards to that, who owns the checking account to which that $250,000 will be deposited into?
DHS. Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, that remains within the control of DHS. The funds and ultimately the training program remain within the control and authority of the Department of Human Services. The Training Orientation Committee really mirrors or mimics our typical labor management committee scenarios that we have with our public employee unions, where unions and agency staff get together and try to collaborate, engage in some problem-solving activities, and in this case, figure out what are some good training opportunities for this group.
Representative Barrett.
Follow-up question to that. So I want to make sure, I think you've said it, but I want to make sure that's true. whatever number of employees get are part of the bargaining unit for SEIU Healthcare. Is that the proper name?
Yes.
Will there be any cross-training with other union members in which that $250,000 will be used? And what I'm trying to get at is making sure that that $250,000 is used for training and it isn't used to support general training that many members would go through that is already being paid for. I want to make sure that that wouldn't be happening and could not be happening under the terms of the legislation, the contract. I'm not sure if I asked a succinct question. If not, I can re-ask it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barrett, I think I do understand the question, and I will say that the intent of the fund is to target and pay for training opportunities that are not currently made available to eligible members of the bargaining unit.
Follow up to that.
Representative Barrett.
So the intent is one thing. But I'm wondering if a contract or a piece of legislation mandates that $250,000, all of it, gets used for specific training, not currently available, only to the members of this bargaining unit.
There is no Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, there is no specific language in the contract to that effect.
Okay.
Counselor, did you have a point to make there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, the provision in the contract that describes the training is Section 4. Effective July 1st, 2016, the state agrees to provide $250,000 per year to the Training and Orientation Committee for providing trainings and orientation to individual providers. The Training and Orientation Committee shall recommend a budget, and DHS shall ensure all expenditures are made in accordance with DHS policies and state law.
Representative Barrett?
My final comment, not a question, is that that seems really loose to me, and I don't think that that supports my concern that that money be used only for training in its totality and only for the members of this particular bargaining unit. Thank you.
DHS has to look over your shoulders on this one, too, don't they, the money part of it?
Senator Metzen, DHS and DHS actually will, with the union, operate the training and orientation committee.
So it's not a free-for-all. You can't just do what...
No.
There are parameters and guidelines, and then the DHS gets involved in it. It's not a pot of money that you could just kind of – that's kind of what I get out of it. Maybe that's simplified, but
– Correct, Senator Metzen. DHS will retain control of the funds and the programs. Does that answer your question appropriately?
Senator Benson, did you
– Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had some questions. I'm on the Human Services Finance Committee, and is this contract severable – in any way? I mean, if we decided to take up the $250,000 but leave the other provisions in, is this severable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I think I will defer that question to Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and members, a contract can only be ratified as a single contract. The legislature isn't able to modify them. There is a provision in the contract, though, that says that the contract is only implemented if there's an appropriation made to pay for it. So there's some ambiguity there about what happens if not all of the appropriation is made. And that'll get figured out when this contract and the appropriations to pay for it get into the Human Services Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's an unlikely scenario in this environment where we have surpluses, but going forward, if we were to face a deficit, how much authority does a Human Services Finance Committee have to alter this contract?
I think it went.
I don't know, but two is
I'm sorry, Senator.
That's all right, Mr. Chair. In times of deficit, when there are, this will be added to the MA forecast. Is my understanding we will not have a separate line item. If we face a deficit in times going forward, what can the legislature do to this contract?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that's unclear what happens with the unique language in this contract that requires that the appropriations be made in order for the contract to be effective. I'm not sure how that plays out over time.
And so, Mr. Chair, this contract cannot compel the legislature to fully fund it. There's nothing in this contract that compels us to vote to fully fund the contract.
Our, Mr. Chair and Senator, our usual understanding is that one legislature can't compel a future legislature. I'm unclear about a contract that provides for a specific amount for a specific purpose, how that would compel a future legislature in terms of its appropriations, if it would require that from the appropriations that DHS receives, it would have to pay this cost. That might be one interpretation, whether or not a specific appropriation is made for that.
But this isn't forever. I mean, we could, like, I think Senator Benson is talking about, if things change, we could certainly modify things, too. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, the legislature can always modify the appropriations. They aren't, the legislature is not able to modify a contract that's in place.
So, next time.
So, Mr. Chair,
if there's tough times going forward.
By modifying the appropriation, we would, in effect, be modifying the contract. Yeah. And I just want that clear and in public, because there may come a time when we can't just take a vote of the membership as negotiated by the DHS commissioner. And we need to be very forthright so that people are not misled into believing that this is a done deal.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just as with any other employee contract, we renegotiate and people come to the table and they negotiate terms in the future. You don't get to pick and we don't, as the legislature, don't pick and choose terms of a negotiated contract. You either accept the contract or you send it back and have it be renegotiated. I mean, that's the way labor contracts work.
But, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, we could say in the Human Services budget that there will be zero additional appropriation, regardless of what the terms of this contract are. We could make that decision this year, and that would fundamentally alter the contract, if not in letter. I want people to understand that the legislature has to appropriate this money. In other employee negotiations, the money is usually put out in the front end. It's part of a budget planned for. This will have to come back regularly and ask for an additional appropriation be added to the MA base.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With every employee contract, it comes to this committee and we approve whether to give them a raise or whether to not, or if we don't approve it, it goes back and they may decide they're going to give increase in wages or they may decide they're going to give increase in benefits. I mean, that happens all the time around here. That's why this committee exists. And so if we don't fund this contract in its entirety, it doesn't go into effect. And that's what the language of this contract says. So that's kind of where we are.
Good point. Further discussion?
Another question, Mr. Chair. So I'm still trying to understand the cost as it relates to the state and also the benefit as it relates to SEIU home health care members. What is there a fiscal note to this contract?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, we're not a fiscal committee. Usually the fiscal notes are prepared at for the fiscal committees in the House and Senate. Typically for labor contracts, the financial information that's provided in the summary and by information provided by MMB, there are not fiscal notes prepared on labor contracts. They rely on the numbers that are provided to in the information to the members.
If I could, I'll rephrase the question. What is the cost of the contract to the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, the last page of the summary shows the impact of each of the components of that contract for the next four fiscal years. The impact on the next biennium, 16-17 biennium, is about $16.2
million. 16.2. I see. Okay.
The other half of the equation that I do not yet know is how much of that increase in potential increase in salary will be transferred to the SEIU union as a whole. Does the union have any information they could share with the committee as far as how much of that they are planning in their Now, as an organization, you, like any other organization, would go through a profit and loss statement. I've done many in my time, in which you look at your costs, you look at your revenue, you look at your bottom line. You look at your costs to determine what you need in order to operate. Have they done that, and are you willing to share with us what portion of the $16 million you would get back through union dues?
It's the same question.
Anybody have the answer to that? Sir, did you want to come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Philip Kryan with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. The labor union is a democratic organization of and by its members, and the members of the union, like Corey, who just spoke, a home care worker who's now on our executive board, are the ones who will decide for themselves what sort of answers they want to give to questions of profit and loss and how the organization, how much resources it needs to function. If they were to guess today at what recommendation they, not I who am staff for the union, but they, the members of the union, if they were to guess today at what recommendation they will make to the membership for a full democratic vote of the membership in terms of the dues structure, they would retain the right to vote to change that the next month or the next year. That's the way that voluntary membership organizations work.
I don't think I heard an answer. Maybe I'll ask it a different way. Of the $16 million, how much of that will be retained by the SEIU organization and not the SEIU members?
As a staff member who works for the members of the union, the union's resources come entirely from the members, and it's my job to take their decisions, which they make democratically as members of the union, and operate within the budget that they give me. And again, they could decide on a due structure today, and they could decide on another one a year from now, because it's up to them as the members, it's up to me as a staff person of the union to operate according to the democratic decisions that they make.
Well, so the answer is you don't know.
Absolutely.
So my only reason for asking that is through a $16 million appropriation, these folks could be already receiving an increase in pay through an appropriation from the state legislature signed by the governor without any representation. $16 million would be directed totally and exclusively to the people doing the work. And so I don't have an answer because that didn't happen. I don't have an answer for how much of that now will be going to those members and how many will be going to you and other overhead related to the SEIU.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, that's right, because the members will decide that for themselves.
Senator Winkler. Representative
Chair, you said that the second time, and it gives me the shivers whenever you say that, and maybe you too.
I know you don't see that as a promotion. I know you well enough to. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we're just sort of asking the same one or two questions over and over again. I thought maybe a better way to summarize it, and that maybe why it's so hard, is that this is representation without taxation. They get the benefits of this organizing without having to pay anything for it, including the PTO. And, you know, I think we can just sort of sit back and say we passed legislation, the Supreme Court weighed in, workers are going to get a raise, they're going to get some PTO, they're going to have a say in their working conditions, and it's not going to cost the legislature or the taxpayers anything. It's free choice, it's voluntary. From a any perspective, this seems to be like a winner, and I don't know why we're kind of dragging these same two questions in over and over again. I'm ready to vote.
Well, Representative Winkler, I would strongly disagree with your representation. I'm not sure what line of work you've come from, but it is highly relevant, and it isn't free. These members are going to be paying money to get that $16 million. So they're paying money. They're getting less than $16 million. Through a direct appropriation, they would have gotten $16 million. But now they're getting less than that. I want to know how much less. So it's not free, Representative Winkler.
Yes, it is.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Hillstrom, I've been doing this for a little while, and usually we don't change too many votes, so we're going to... My daddy taught me how to count when I was, 4 years old or 3 years old, and... That doesn't mean we don't have a full discussion and listen to everybody. But Senator, I represent Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still trying to. I'm digging into the contract here and reading a little bit of it. I've got a copy. Reverend Barrett doesn't. The fiscal intermediary. I was trying to read the definition of what a fiscal intermediary is. Maybe if the assistant commissioner could tell us what they are, who they are, how they operate. We are apparently requiring them to distribute information about the union, to collect the dues. Mr. Vandenberg, Ms. Cordes, can you tell us how that works?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski. The fiscal intermediaries are basically the agencies or pass-through fiscal agents that issue paychecks to these individuals. The statute requires that DHS require the agencies to operationalize a dues deduction structure once the dues are put in place by the union. And I'm sorry, I may have missed part of your question.
What are their other requirements? They're required to distribute literature about promoting the union and giving them the ability to do dues checkoff and those. Can you tell us more about that?
Because it's a union that is formed pursuant to PELRA, we did make some decisions in bargaining that would mimic some of the rights that our other public employee contracts provide for. And that does include state opportunities to our bargaining units to have access to members and to distribute literature.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So, Ms. Cordes, dues will be collected by these fiscal intermediaries, which are businesses.
Yes.
Is that correct? So they're businesses that employ PCAs in the workplace.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, they are private businesses, whether they're PCA choice agencies or pass-through fiscal agents, yes.
Okay. One last line of questioning, Mr. Chair.
Well, absolutely.
I didn't see anywhere, Ms. Cordes, in the contract that talks about how people can opt out of the union and when and how that operationally happens. Can you tell us how that happens?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Druskowski, there is a provision that does say that union members can, upon proper authorization, withdraw their membership from the union. I believe there's also reference to a notice requirement that the union has to comply with to the fiscal intermediary so that they can stop the dues deductions.
Can you, Mr. Chair,
Representative Druskowski,
wonder if Ms. Cordes could point us to a place in the contract that is.
You see it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, it would be on page 4. The second paragraph of section 1 relating to dues checkoff. In all cases, the last two sentences, in all cases, authorizations for deductions shall be continuously effective unless properly canceled with the union by the individual provider or worker. And then it also references the cancellation notice to the fiscal intermediary.
So is it, Mr. Chair, Ms. Cortes, thank you. Is there anywhere that limits the time or of the year or anything that that the individual provider could initiate that? I mean, it says that the union shall provide 10 days notice of such cancellations to the fiscal intermediary, but it doesn't talk about any limitations. So what I'm reading, or what I think I'm reading, is that they can do that at any time during the year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, according to this language, they could withdraw their membership at any time during the year. I don't know if when the union sets up its due structures, if they will have any particular notice requirements, so to speak, or cancellation windows that they'll establish as part of their process in setting up the due structure.
Wow. So again, Mr. Chair, my concern here is that the people entering into this contract are not aware of things that are yet to be developed in determining their agility within the contract to move in and out of it or in or out of it. And so that's my concern with this. It's full understanding of the members who are going to join it, and this seems to be kind of a hasty process, Mr. Chair, and one that doesn't have a lot of deliberation or discussion or communication happening, as far as I can tell. So those are my concerns with the way that this process and this contract's come forward.
Well, it'll go full disclosure going forward, then you could get out of it if you choose not to along, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they can withdraw and will not be subject to fair share fees like our public employee unions are.
But, Mr. Chair, Ms. Cortes just testified that there may be in the bylaws or wherever the dues structure is developed, which is going to be outside of this contract, that there may be limitations on the ability for members to opt in or out based on yet to be determined dues, structures, timing, amounts, and arrangements.
Ms. Cortes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, I really can't speak on behalf of SEIU in terms of how those dues deductions will be structured. I'm really thinking of it in terms of our other public sector employee unions where they do have generally some notice requirements that are part of the dues authorization forms that people sign. But I, again, cannot speak on behalf of it.
Senator Eaton, did you have a comment on this?
Yeah, for example, in AFSCME and in M&A, you sign a card withdrawing from the union, and it can take up to 30 days for that to go into effect because they have to change the payroll and the computer and so on. But.
And that's your option, of course, obviously.
Yeah. And then we would go fair share in those, but not in this one.
Further discussion? Okay, I think we've had it. And Representative Barrett, I want to assure you and any other member that wants a full copy of the contract, we'll get it to you going forward. I think that's a fair point, and some of us have seen a few of them over the years, but let some people have it. So we'll get them out to the members, every member. Oh, is that, do you understand that? From now on. And that's an excellent point. I think that's very fair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Eaton.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the SDR 1.
Okay. And that?
That recommend that the negotiated agreement entered into between SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget be submitted to that was submitted to the committee on March 2nd, 2015, be ratified by the legislature.
On that motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Further, I think there's any other items as far as I also with that, thank you, members, for very good discussion, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very Very good. Meeting's adjourned.